I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special broadcast of Writers on a New England Stage with uber-popular author Dan Brown. Before the break, Brown talked about how his personal pursuit of the unknown evolved and how that inquiry led him to write novels highlighting the historic conflict between religion and science. In 2003, Brown published The Da Vinci Code. The book debuted at number one on the New York Times bestsellers list and became a lightning rod for controversy.
The controversial book, The Da Vinci Code, is poised for worldwide release as a movie this week. There's already been a strong Asian backlash.
That Dan Brown is making the assertion the Gospels of the New Testament hijack old heretical ideas and wraps them in a fast-paced novel. So people are reading the novel, and they're getting the idea, number one, that Jesus Christ isn't God at all.
Certamente è deprecabile.
It's certainly disturbing that no respect is being shown for the hundreds of millions of people who believe in Christ, the Church, and the Gospels. But it's the result of ignorance and arrogance.
The Da Vinci Code's extraordinary success changed Dan Brown's life and cast him as a polarizing figure. The normally private New Hampshire writer found himself targeted as a person of interest by people on all sides of the ideological divide.
About a year after The Da Vinci Code was published, I was in Boston, and a priest walked up to me on the street, and he proclaimed very loudly, "Mr. Brown, I don't like your novel one bit." Before I could figure out how to respond, the priest broke into a big smile, and he added, "But I just had to come over here and thank you. Every Wednesday night for the past 10 years, I've held Bible study in my office, and every Wednesday night, I've had the same 8 people show up. Last week, I printed the usual notice in our church bulletin reminding people of the Bible study and noting that this week's topic was the Da Vinci Code. We had hundreds of people show up for Bible study. We had to move the meeting out into our church to fit them all. I've been trying to get these people interested in this stuff for years. Talking about your novel isn't quite how I imagined it, but I'm grateful that the dialogue is happening." I believe it is our duty as reflective people to spark dialogue. And this is really one of the reasons I write. Writing, however, is a very isolating pursuit. I'm guessing, actually, that we have some writers here tonight. Where are the writers? Professional, amateur? Okay, a bunch of you. Look at those tormented faces. George Orwell once said, "Writing a book is an exhausting struggle, like a long bout of some painful illness." Another famous author, when asked if he enjoyed being a writer, he cleverly answered, "I enjoy having written." Franz Kafka was a bit more direct. "Writing is utter solitude, the descent into the cold abyss of oneself." Cheery guy. In any case, you get the idea. Writing's not the most fun you ever had. It's solitary, schizophrenic, filled with demons and doubts, accompanied by the incessant voices of imaginary characters talking in your head 24 hours a day, often drowning out the voices of the real people in your life. Those of you who know writers can attest, writers become strange people when they're writing. I would like to share the single truest statement I've ever heard about the life of a writer. "There could be only one existence more miserable than being a writer, and that is being the spouse of a writer." Yeah. My wife does it so gracefully. Why don't you stand up? Have we got some light somewhere? Stand up. You have no idea what this woman endures. Blythe, in addition to being my number one researcher and first-pass editor, is a perpetually grounding force in my life. In Blythe's world, the New York Times bestseller list has no relevance whatsoever to who takes out the trash or empties the dishwasher. At the height of the Da Vinci Code's popularity, a major news magazine ran the cover story, "Does Christianity have anything to fear from Dan Brown?" So I, feeling quite influential, put the magazine on Blythe's desk so she could see just how important a man she had married. Later that day, the magazine was back on my desk with one passage highlighted. It was a quote from a prominent British priest who responded to the question on the cover with the following statement. Christian theology has survived the writings of Galileo and the writings of Darwin. Surely it will survive the writings of some novelist from New Hampshire. So I quietly put the magazine back on, you know, I put the magazine in the trash and took out the trash, actually, right after that. There is nothing in our DNA that predetermines our beliefs. We are not born into this world believing that a particular God is the true God. We are born into a culture. We worship the gods of our parents. If all of us in this room had been born in the mountains of Tibet, most of us would be Buddhists. And we would hold on to that Buddhist philosophy with all the same passion that we now hold on to our current beliefs. The world is getting smaller every day. And now, more than ever, there is enormous danger in believing we are infallible, that our version of the truth is absolute, and that everyone who does not think like us is wrong and therefore an enemy. For our own survival, it is critical that we live with open minds, that we ask difficult questions, and above all, that we engage in dialogue, especially with those whose ideas are not our own. Religion will not survive the modern world if having religion forbids the use of our intellect, if it demands absolute belief without permitting inquiry, if it proclaims answers but outlaws questions. When our children pose tough questions about faith, it's not enough simply to respond, "Nice boys and girls don't ask that question." When our children ask why we believe something, it's not enough merely to respond, "Because that's what we've always believed." By that argument, we should still be burning witches and claiming that the sun revolves around the earth. Religion is a work in progress. It learns from its mistakes, it evolves and matures, and that's what keeps religion exciting and relevant in the modern world. I've said this before, but I believe that religion has only one true enemy, apathy. That is, all of us becoming so caught up in the chaos of our busy lives that spirituality takes a back seat. Apathy has no better antidote than passionate debate and dialogue. And so to close, I want to acknowledge that tonight, what has brought us together in this space are two rare organizations that urge us to educate ourselves, to ask questions, and to engage in dialogue. And for that, New Hampshire Public Radio and the Portsmouth Music Hall, we are very, very grateful. Thank you.
Author Dan Brown, speaking there in front of a live audience at the Portsmouth Music Hall to benefit the Writers on a New England Stage series. I sat down with the Da Vinci Code author to talk with him and pose questions from the audience about his books, his life, and his writing process. We began, as he did, with his first ever book of a mysterious grouping of seemingly disparate and perhaps symbolic beings.
I'm looking at all the questions here, and most of the questions from the audience have to do with one thing. I hope you can talk about that tonight.
Let's see what it is.
Well, it's cracking the mystery and meaning of this secret society called the Giraffe, the Pig, and the Pants on Fire. And I wonder if, you know, we can open that up a little.
I don't know what to say about this book. It is...
It's a hashtag on Twitter already, so you might as well deal with it.
You know, the funny thing about that book is that the character in it is named Jacques. I don't know why. I do know why. I had a friend when I was five named Jacques. But the amazing thing is I hadn't thought about this book for years, and I looked at the opening chapter of The Da Vinci Code, and it starts with a character named Jacques Saunier, and I could not believe it. So, full circle.
Okay. I want to know if you had any idea, Dan Brown, that you would be kicking up such a hornet's nest when you published The Da Vinci Code.
You know, I really didn't. I mean, I knew that some of the ideas were controversial. I did not quite imagine how controversial. I think I was mainly surprised that you could put these ideas forth in a novel and that people would get so upset about it. I grew up, obviously, in a household that encouraged inquiry. And I guess some people didn't. And that was very surprising for me to find out.
You were talking about the inspiration of dialogue. One of the great things about this book is that people are talking about religion. They're talking about their belief in God. And actually, I was reading today about the Vatican has opened up its secret archives. They're on display.
Finally.
Now at Rome's Capitolone Museums, said to be on the Pope's orders to dispel the myths opened up by the Da Vinci Code.
They didn't open the real one. Let's not get too excited.
Well, that's one of the questions. I mean, are people, can they really get a handle on what's in there by looking at this museum?
You know, the funny thing about the Vatican Secret Archives is there are things in there that people have never seen. Mm-hmm. There's so much material, and a lot of it is written in very ancient languages, and it takes a lot of time to translate and to understand. I don't think that scholars outside of the Vatican will ever really have a good handle on what's there.
What about, you mentioned the medical researcher who is conducting research on stem cells, but also morally finds that reprehensible. So is that actually religion and science, or is that religion and politics at this point?
I think it's more ethics. I think it's very, very, I mean, to me it's a fascinating question. You take something like stem cells, and there are a lot of people who are very upset that we are harvesting them, and fair enough. And yet, if you know somebody who's sick and that technology could cure them, it's a real ethical dilemma as to whether or not we use our minds or we use our hearts. And I don't think there are any clear-cut answers. I think in the end, our minds will win because science is just too powerful. But I think it'll take some time.
Well, you've opened up a lot of provocative questions. What is your role, or do you feel like you have a role in continuing the dialogue? You know, publicly you have these conversations, you know, you've given a lot of talks, sure, obviously, but about sort of teasing out those sore points.
I found that the easiest way to think of it is just you sort of throw a grenade into a room and then you run away. I rather listen to other people talk about these ideas than sort of put forth my own ideas. I have very specific ideas, but I don't tend to share them. I argue both sides of the equation and let people think on their own.
Well, somebody wants to know if you're a member of the Priory of Sion or the Knights Templar.
I heard the Priory was a hoax. I don't know.
Come on, Dan. No one here will tell, right?
Not as far as you know. There are three members of the Priory in the audience. Oh, they're leaving. They're the cloaked guys leaving. Sorry, guys.
I looked at so many books and videos that say cracking the Da Vinci Code, decoding the lost symbol. And many of them, you know, right next to videos that say, see a photograph of a live ghost in a cemetery.
Right.
I mean, does that bother you that your books are getting lumped in some ways in this kind of conspiratorial, metaphysical realm?
Not in the least. You know, there are people who like all sorts of different styles. I mean, for me, that reminds me that I'm reaching an entire group of people who doesn't, don't think about big topics. They're thinking about ghosts, and if suddenly they're thinking about Masonic philosophy or the life of Jesus, that's terrific.
You and Robert Langdon share a birthday, I notice.
We do.
And you also, although you're not wearing it tonight, favor kind of turtlenecks and tweed jackets. What does Dan Brown have that Robert Langdon
doesn't?
You know,
it's funny. I've had people come up and say, now, you're Robert Langdon, right? I said, no, of course not. Robert Langdon is much cooler. He's much smarter. And I had a woman once who came up to me and said, now, wait a minute. Everything Robert Langdon says and thinks comes out of your head, so how can he be smarter? And I had to point out that when Langdon sort of has some smart quip off the cuff, that took me about 3 days to figure out.
There was a multi-year break between the Da Vinci Code and the
Lost
Symbol.
That's a very polite way to put it, a multi-year break. There was a vast ocean of time, we can all say.
What happened? I mean, it was a huge book, obviously,
sure.
But How do you follow up something like that? There's a lot of pressure. Your print run on The Lost Symbol was what? The 6.5 million, you know, the largest ever.
Yeah, certainly there was pressure. There was pressure to follow up The Da Vinci Code. The other thing that happened is my life changed dramatically after that book was published, and I had to get used to, I mean, Blythe and I both had to get used to a much different kind of life. Mm-hmm. We had, all sorts of wonderful opportunity and simultaneously a bunch of challenges that we just weren't used to.
Well, you're known to be a very disciplined writer. I'm sure people would be really interested. In fact, a couple of people asked about your writing routine. I'd love to hear more about it.
Well, I was speaking to somebody about it earlier, and I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning every day, and somebody says, so at 4 o'clock, what are you doing at your computer? And I admit, I play Angry Birds till about 6. So, that's right. Then I switch to backgammon, and, you know, around noon I get started. I believe that there is a very close tie between the dream state, when your mind is creating something out of nothing, and the process of writing. So I personally try to move from bed to the computer as quickly as possible and really harvest that state of mind that is, I believe, the most creative time of the day.
I heard you also hang upside down.
Guilty as charged.
Fangs?
No fangs. I'm writing a book about vampires, and I figured, you know, no. I got interested in gravity boots a long time ago. They're great for anyone who sits for long hours, but they're also, I found, fantastic for kind of looking at the world in a new perspective. Mm-hmm. And I'm convinced that all of the ambigrams and upside-down ideas in Angels and Demons probably stem from the fact that I hung upside down quite a bit during that book.
So what is that for?
You're making me sound very strange. No. You know that?
That's no, right. Nothing like that. But I find that fascinating. I mean, is it because you just have to take a break and, you know, yoga, people who practice yoga stand on their head so that the blood rushes to their head? Is it to get ideas going?
Well, you know what's funny? I first did it because I heard it was great for your eyes. My eyes got very tired looking at the computer. And somebody said, you know what? If you flood the retinal nerve with oxygenated blood using this, you'll be able to see better. It didn't work, but I had all these great ideas, so I just kept doing it.
Have you ever had writer's block?
No, I kind of have the other problem.
Too much?
Won't tell you what we call it. Anyway, use your imaginations. No, I'm fortunate that I have a whole lot of ideas. Literally, for every page in The Da Vinci Code, or really any novel I've written, for every page there were 10 that I threw in the trash. I, for some reason, am a writer who doesn't get it right the first time. Editing really is the most important part, self-editing, mm-hmm. of the writing process. In fact, there was a famous writer who said the difference between writers who get published and writers who don't get published is that good writers know when they're bad. Mm-hmm. And that really is, at least in my case, a good part of writing.
A lot of people are asking about when your next book is coming out.
My next book is, I'm having a great time with it. I am well into the writing process, have finished the research process. There is no date announced. I've learned not to predict, but it's another Robert Langdon thriller, and it is set in Europe in one of the most fascinating places I've ever been fortunate enough to go, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. That's all I can really say.
Nobody here is going to tell if you told us just a little bit more, right?
None of your millions of listeners. That's right, okay.
Well, thanks for telling us that much. There are a lot of people who are asking for advice for first-time authors who would like to get published.
You know, I've heard people say, write what you know. I don't believe that. I think you should write what you don't know. I think you should find a topic that fascinates you and educate yourself about it. Mm-hmm. The other thing to do is never try to chase a fad. Write the book you would want to read and then just hope other people share your taste. And that really is what I do every day. I write the page that I would want to read, and I just hope someone else shares my taste.
One of my colleagues is here tonight. She and her husband are true crime writers, and they were advised never, ever write about the mob. Now, would you say to first-time writers, don't write about the Catholic Church?
No. Are you kidding? The Vatican has a great publicity arm, apparently. I think you should write about what interests you and do it with care and fairness. I don't think that there is anything that's off limits.
This may go along with it. As a Catholic and former resident of Cleveland's Little Italy, I've always considered the Roman Catholic Church as Cosa Nostra's big brother. Any chance of a book with this connection?
No way.
Okay, we're kind of bringing another full
Moving
circle
right along.
Out there. Well, I was so fascinated looking back through your books and some that I had read previously and had to revisit. But The Digital Fortress, now this was published in 1998. long before 9/11, long before the Patriot Act, long before people were asking big questions and had fear about electronic surveillance. I wonder what that experience would be like for you writing it now. What do you think?
It would be a much different book, because the thing that worked about Digital Fortress is it was talking about topics that nobody knew anything about. At the time, literally 3% of the population had heard of the National Security Agency. This was the days of AOL and CompuServe, you know, the you've got mail. We all thought it was private. We'd say whatever we wanted in email. And that book came about through an interesting series of events. At Phillips Exeter Academy, there was a time when the Secret Service showed up on campus just to question one of the students, a German student, because they had seen in his email that he'd said something not so nice about the president. And they came just to question him, and it was nothing. It was just a passing thing, and they left, and there was nothing that happened about it. But I was fascinated. I thought, how did they find out what was in this kid's email? And at that point, I did some research and found out about the NSA, found out about these giant computers that comb for keywords. And I literally, Blythe will attest to this, I literally one day sat up in bed and said, I'm going to write a novel. And Blythe literally patted me on the head and said, you go right ahead. And so I did.
I know that you pursued a career in music, most of it. You released a couple of songs, at least, in CD compilations when
I sold dozens of records, folks. Dozens. The first dozen to my mom, the second, I'm not sure where they went.
When did you decide to make the switch?
In college, I played a lot of piano, and I also wrote a lot, short stories and things. And out of college, I thought, well, geez, should I write music or should I write books? And I thought music would be much more fun. I moved out to Los Angeles and got a record deal, very fortunately, and made a record with a bunch of famous people, and the record bombed. And so I made another, and that one bombed too. And at about that time, I wrote a strange little humor book that really was nothing. It took a weekend to write, and the first editor who saw it bought it for a whole lot of money for that little, and I thought, wow, publishing sure is easy.
Was this 187 Men to
you're
Avoid?
You're not actually supposed to say the name
Sorry.
Of the book. I'm very ashamed of this book, but it opened the door to
a
terrific
people are dying to buy it now in Biblio.
I know. Well, it's actually been it's been re-released, and I'm sure it will have a special anniversary edition now, thanks to you. it was just 187 Men to Avoid, you know, men who dress their dogs, that sort of thing. Brilliant stuff, brilliant.
By Dan and Danielle Brown?
Well, I thought if I used a pseudonym, nobody would ever find out it was me, that I could pay my rent, but it didn't work out that way.
Well, people are still wondering about your musical career. A lot of people want to know about your favorite music, your groups or bands.
I grew up listening to a lot of classical music. My mom was a professional organist and a keyboardist. I think my first 45 was Still the One by the Orleans. I listened to all sorts of stuff. I loved Neil Diamond. I loved Barry Manilow, I'm sorry to say. Yeah, great songwriter. Don't laugh at Barry. That's right.
Who doesn't love Mandy?
Mandy, one of the greatest songs ever written.
You talked about everybody falling on some place in the continuum of faith. Where do you think you fall on that continuum?
This would probably be dodging the question, but I kind of consider my faith a work in progress. The more I learn, the more I realize I don't know. And so it's kind of the strange catch-22 when you keep exploring, and the more you learn, the more you realize I'm just lost. It's a very strange world out there, and in both science and religion.
What do you think your public least understands about Dan Brown?
Probably my love of privacy.
Good answer, Dan Brown.
Face through a window, crying in the night. The night goes into morning, just another.
Author Dan Brown there, recorded in front of a live audience at the Portsmouth Music Hall. The event was a benefit for the Writers on a New England Stage series. Executive producer and live stage presentation director of the series is Patricia Lynch. New Hampshire Public Radio president is Betsy Gardella. Executive broadcast producer of the program is Rebecca Lavoie. Live producer, Taylor Quimby. Associate producer and communications director is Margaret Talcott. Associate producer is Tom Holbrook of River Run Bookstore. The live sound and recording engineer is Mike Marchand. Musical director and band is Bob Lord and Dreadnought.
To hear other authors from this series, visit nhpr.org and click on the Writers on a New England Stage link. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Standing on the edge of time, I've walked away when